Welcome to the School of Hollywood. I'm Steve Owens, your host. I interview celebrities in Hollywood and talk about their success and how they got to the current status. So if you like the podcast, please share it with your friends and give us a like.
Hi, this is Steve Owens, and today I've got Simon with me, who has got a project out there right now called The Real George Michael. I'm very excited about this project for two reasons. One, I got the platinum for I Want Your Sex, but Careless Whisper is my all-time favorite song. Played it, I cannot tell you how many times I played it when I worked in radio. And, you know, I was reading about this particular record, and it had several years before it became a hit.
Well, they wrote it. Andrew and George wrote it together on the bus over several days on their way home from school. So when they were 17, it didn't. When Wham first signed a record contract, they had this song. In fact, that's what got them the record contract. But everyone thought this is not the song to start with. This isn't Wham. I mean, this isn't, you know, the image you've got of these two happy-go-lucky kids out and about the town, dancing, having fun. This is a record for later on. So it's fantastic to know that we had in our hand a track which is almost certainly a number one, and we didn't have to start with it. We could put it anywhere we wanted in the process. But it was extraordinary. You know, a 17-year-old can write a song of such sophistication. You know, it's the sort of song, well, I think it was, somebody says it in the film who we interview. You know, it was amazing to hear us. It has that French boulevardier, you know, Charles Aznavour sophistication in the lyric. And here's a kid of 17 writing it. It's almost impossible to believe.
But I heard it went through several different times of being produced before it actually became the hit.
Well, I had this brilliant idea. Being a manager, I have to have brilliant ideas. And I said, you know, this is a great soul song. And we should go to America. And I'll call Jerry Wexler, who I knew from years before. I'm going to call Jerry and send it to him. He's the guy to make it. And of course, George, what did he say? You know, Jerry produced Aretha Franklin and all the greatest, Percy Sledge and all those great songs. And George said, brilliant, fantastic. And, you know, Jerry came straight back to me, said, love the song, let's do it. We booked Muscle Shoals. George and I flew over, we went under Muscle Shoals. And it wasn't really very good. I mean, it wasn't terrible, because nothing coming out of Muscle Shoals is terrible. But, you know, the problem is that Muscle Shoals is you've got a band in there who play two or three sessions a day, probably two or three songs a session, nine sessions a day. They probably come up with 60 top 10 hits a year. But nine sessions, nine songs a day, 300 days a year, they're making 4,000 tracks a year, or 3,000 tracks a year, and they come up with 60 hits. And so there's a tendency sometimes for them just to get a bit, you know, it's just a bad Monday. You know, you play perfectly well, absolutely perfectly, but it doesn't have that little extra lift, that flair, which certain happens on some days. And George came back, he said, it doesn't have it. And he was right, it was perfect, but it didn't have it. You know, if you can understand that. And we both agreed, and he went back in the studio in London and got it. I mean, I think what sells that song as much as the song is that extraordinary flowing track. I mean, it just grabs you in the first, even without the voice on it, you heard that track, you said, wow, I want to hear this all day. Just keep playing the track. And that's what you didn't get in Muscle Shoals. Which is a pity, because Jerry was very upset, but it wasn't quite there. You know? It must have happened a lot of time for him before. It couldn't be something he'd only just experienced once.
Actually, what's kind of funny is Dave Stewart from WCBS in New York today actually posted on his Instagram a video of a street band playing Careless Whisper. and it was interesting. I was like, wow, we're talking tonight. So
were they good?
No, they were. let's put it this way. There's nothing that's going to replace the original.
No, it's fantastic. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I think we played that when it came out and on the station, probably 50 weeks, it stayed in the top 20.
I mean, this is the thing about some of George's songs is, You don't get tired of them. Now, it's not just because I manage him or because I was involved with him, because I'm quite objective about these things. There's a lot of songs you don't get tired of. That's not unique to him. I mean, I never get tired of Sting, you know, and everything you, I can't remember. Is it what's called Watching You? I'll be watching you, isn't it? No, I never get tired of that. It comes on, I think, oh, not again. And within a second, I think, I can't stop listening. You know, it's a brilliantly made record. Wham's records, that one, Last Christmas. I know it's a Christmas song, but it's just so magical. When you're walking around the shopping center at Christmas, it comes on again. And You know, when Mariah Carey comes on again, you sort of go, oh, no, not again. Because it has all the elements of a commercially written song. Let's write a hit Christmas song, put in all the right words, you know, Santa Claus and down the chimney and all this. And then George's song comes on, and it's not really about Christmas at all. I know it says last Christmas, but it could have been last week, you know. It's a song about teenage angst. It's like one of the great Carole King songs, you know. And it happens to be Christmas. And that's why it works so brilliantly. You don't get tired of it.
So you have the documentary, The Real George Michael. What made you decide to actually produce the documentary?
I managed George with Wham. I managed Wham. After Wham, I didn't manage him as a solo artist. But of course, having managed him and been involved with his brilliance and fun and everything about him, you couldn't not watch the rest of his career like you'd watch the career of a good friend or a relative or something. I mean, it was fascinating to watch it. Although I didn't actually want to manage it because, he was a difficult artist. All great artists are difficult. And I could see he was going to go through some difficult times, and I just didn't fancy going through all that. But I watched him with fascination, and every time we met, it was a big hug and how things are going. And then got to the, you know, there are moments in your life when you think, I've been a rock manager. I've come from a good home. I'm well educated. You know, have I wasted my life? Is that the right thing to have done to be a rock manager? You know, I perhaps could have gone into parliament, into politics, or been a doctor or a scientist. I've been a damn rock manager. What a waste of time. And you have to think. And there are one or two artists who come along and make you think, no, it was definitely worth it. Because those artists transcend pop and rock. They do something. After all, it is art, and art, we need art. It reflects back our lives and teaches about ourselves. And George was such an extraordinary person. I mean, as a writer, as an artist, the way he lived, the way he really helped gay people see gay as being normal. You could just, you know, be yourself, and you didn't have to have any, more than no shame. You just didn't even have to consider it as anything other than just another way of living normally. A really wonderful person, and I thought, somebody needs to make a good film about him. And I looked at all the films. There are a lot of them out there, four or five films. And they all have this slight sensationalism about them, sensationalism. And they have these commentaries which would tell you what was happening or what he was thinking or what he did next. And I hate that. I like it just to happen naturally. So I thought I'd get a whole lot of people who knew him well, who worked with him, who sang his songs, like Stevie Wonder, Rufus Wainwright, produced him, did videos, friends, and have them all talk about him. And then from that, find all the new things and things I didn't know and things other people wouldn't know. And then string them together as a story. So there'd be no commentary at all. One person would blend into the next one and they'd tell the story together. And I think it's worked very successfully. And it just felt to me he deserved that. He deserved something which told his story properly without any one person putting their hyperbole on it. And hopefully that's what we achieved.
Perfect. Was there anything that came out in the documentary about him that you didn't really know in his career?
Yeah. I mean, two things specifically. One is, although I'd been in a studio with him, with Wham, when he was recording, I had never realized he never, ever wrote down his lyrics. Now, you know, of course he wrote his lyrics, but he wrote them in his mind and he kept them in his mind. I mean, you go shopping, you write down a shopping list. If you haven't written the shopping list, you're going to forget something, you know. Or you before you go to bed, you write down tomorrow's what I've got to do list. And you wake up in the morning, you look at it. You imagine you never, ever wrote those things down and it has to jump up like a photographic memory. When he went in the studio, he had in his mind a whole bag of lyrics, you know, like 30 possible lines here. And he tried them out. He'd sing them into the microphone. No, that doesn't quite work. I'll put that one instead or just change that word. But he wasn't reading them off a bit of paper. And I'd never noticed that when I'd been in a studio previously. I hadn't noticed that. And then both the producers he worked with told the story that they were astonished that he came in the studio and just sang out of his head. Well, of course, he wasn't inventing the lyrics at that moment, but he was recalling them from something he'd written and stored away in his brain. And I thought that's an amazing talent to have. I mean, a strange talent to have. But it was that surprised and quite shocked me. And the other thing was his incredible philanthropy, that he would sit at home in his later life, he'd sit at home, watch television, and almost any time somebody on television told some sort of story, you know, a talk show that somebody's mum needed an operation and they couldn't afford it, or somebody lost his teeth and couldn't afford a new set, he'd call up the radio station and say, tell them they can have them and send their money over. But the only condition he made was, you mustn't mention my name. And so he was doing this for years and years and years, you know, giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars to people who had things like that, who needed them. Besides the very big money he gave away to the big charities, like the Ethiopian Children's Fund and the Terence Higgins Trust, which was a gay fund, which he gave all the royalties to almost his best-selling album, to, which is his greatest hits album. Astonishing generosity.
He has one of the most unique voices out there. You know it every time you hear a record on there. What kind of microphone did he use to capture
that? I don't know. I'm not an engineer. I don't suppose he knew. He knew who was his engineer or who was his producer, and he said, get out the mic. But I doubt if George knew what mic and I didn't. but in fact, Chris Porter, who was his producer and talks in the film, did say it probably didn't get in the film because, you know, you end up with 3 hours of an engineer and nothing else. He probably did tell me what the mic was, but I remember him saying that he engineered a mic setup where there were two mics and they worked in tandem in some way, and that became George's sound. I think he does say that in the film, but he doesn't say what the actual mic was.
Yeah, listening to the vocals, there definitely is no auto-tune that you can hear out of. He is an incredible singer, or was an incredible singer.
Never auto-tune. Well, the auto-tune really wasn't around then. I mean, you couldn't fake it. Nowadays, you can use an auto-tune and perhaps nobody will know. In those days, if you put on what was auto-tune, it really sounded like Donald Duck, so you weren't going to use it.
What was your process of going through finding the footage for the documentary?
The process was taking a long time. I mean, I just looked and looked. I mean, of course, nowadays with YouTube and computers, it's not like it used to be. When I made my, I mean, I started making documentaries about 5-6 years ago, 5-6 years before COVID, so 8 years ago now. And the first one I made was about Frank Sinatra. And at that stage, you couldn't find it on the internet. You had to go to libraries. And the difference is just astonishing. I mean, what took a year and a half now could be done in 3 or 4 months. But it was an incredible search. You think you put in every possible cue word to find every last thing, and there's nothing left you haven't seen. And then one day, suddenly, something will just pop up. And you're, amazing. Where did that come from? You know? And so it was just searching and searching and searching. And I did find stuff no one had seen before, or very few people had seen before. Some of it's been repeated in other George Michael films since, having seen my film in an early stage, rushed and got it. But I don't mean that's fine. I mean, there's that extraordinary interview in Australia. Now, that was always available, but somehow no one had seen it because it was that particular channel hadn't put a title on it, which came up when you searched. And it was, that's an extraordinary interview, don't you think, Sam? That really very nasty man, very unpleasant man, who the first question of an hour-long interview is, are you gay? You know? And George made a big mistake because you can see it on screen. He said no. And even as he said it, you could see him wishing he'd said yes, but he wasn't going to go back on what he said. I mean, you can almost see him just, damn it, the wrong word. The wrong word has come out. This was the moment to say, damn it, I am. And then he had to recap and say, it's none of your business what I do and who I sleep with. But it was an unpleasant interview. I don't think anyone could look at that and like that interview.
What do you think George's impact was on the music industry and the popular culture?
You know, I mean, he was popular within the music industry. I don't even know. You know, when he sued Sony over this very contentious thing, which is something it came really from me when I talked to him way back in the WAM days. The outrageous thing that a record company owns your copyright. They use your money to make the records. But when it's repaid, they advance you the money, you make your record, and then they take the money they advance you back for royalties. It's like mortgaging a house. The bank lends you the money, and then you pay it off. And then when you've paid it off, the bank give you the house. But the record company don't give you the record. They keep the record. So you've paid for your own record, and they own the copyright. It's not temporary, it's for life. And it's outrageous. And I've always said it's outrageous. And there are historical reasons why this happens. And I wrote a book about the music business. It's called The Business, which is the entire history of the music industry. It explains why these things happened and why they've become standard, but it doesn't really make them right. And it is an outrageous thing that this happens. And so when he sued Sony about that, most of the music industry, most of the, when I say the music industry, the corporate end, 60% of the music business, it's like the music business government, you know, the corporations who run it and have a system. Most of them were very, very anti-George for that. They said, you know, if we don't own the copyright, then we can't afford to invest. And the music business, as you know, it is over. George said, perhaps if the music business, as we know it, is over, that would be a good thing. Let's have a new music business, as we don't know it. You know, but mostly the industry was against him winning that case. And quite a lot of people who I respect a lot, who I like, who I always thought was good liberal thinkers, came out against him and said, no, this would destroy the industry. Well, I think they're very small thinkers. I don't think anyone can believe that an artist should pay to make his own records and then not own them. It seems absurd.
He had a very controversial record, and I was one of the first people to chart it on Billboard and Radio and Records, Want Your Sex, and got a platinum for it. Tell me the story behind that record.
Well, it was an extraordinary thing. First of all, initially, George wrote it with a guy called David Austin, who is one, his best friend and stayed his best friend right through his life, and wrote a lot of songs with him. He was also the co-writer of You Have Been Loved. But he wrote it with David for David. He decided it's time David had a chance of being a star. So just, you know, well, Wham was still in progress. He went in the studio with David to write a song to give David a hit. And as the song progressed, George realized that it was a pretty unusual song and would be quite controversial. And that David probably didn't have the character, the strength of personality to sustain it. George felt you needed someone who's already a star in order to sing a song like that. It wouldn't be a good launch single for anybody. And so he said to David, I'm going to do it. And David was quite upset because he could see it was a hit too. On the other hand, he was realistic and he was going to now be a co-writer of a George Michael song. It was pretty good. And it was going to
ching,
be
ching, ching.
Yeah, and it was going to be the song with which George launched his solo career. So this was going to be pretty big. So George went and remade it. He went to the studio in Denmark where he set about remaking it. And he had all these ideas. It was very minimalist. He copied the way Prince sounded. Quite a stark track, very funky. And George doesn't write music. So he had these ideas section by section. So he said, the next section we want to hear, the brass wants to go da-da-da-da. And this was not for him to sing. This was just putting the track down, which he'd sing over later. So he'd sing all the parts for the brass players and tell the rhythm players what they should play for the next 8 bars. And then the entire brass section and the rhythm section, everybody, you know, bass, drums, piano, brass section, would record the next 8 bars. So the engineer was dropping it in 8 bars at a time. But it's usually when you drop in, you've done a track, last 4 minutes, and you're replacing bits. You know, but this wasn't replacing. This was 8 bars, and at the end of it, well, boom, it would stop dead. And then the next bit had to go straight in on top of that. The engineer said it's the most difficult thing he'd ever done. It was like, you know, it's like the worst examination you could ever be put through. You know? And if you got something wrong with the dropping, that just wrecked the previous bit you just recorded. So you have to go back on that again. You know? And if you got something wrong dropping that in the second time, you go back to the beginning. It was totally riveting nightmare for him. But when you listen to the track now, you can't hear it. It seems absolutely seamless.
And that was an analog tape, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is all done on probably 16-track tape, but 2-inch 16-track tape. No digital. So it really had to be dropped in physically. And, you know, there's a delay. So when you press the button, there's a, you know, eighth of a second or a tenth of a second delay. So as the engineer, you really have to know exactly what that all is. You know, and it's incredible. You just listen to it. It's a great track. But for the engineer, anyone who knows how it was made, you say it's impossible. It's a technological nightmare which can't be solved. He solved it.
So where can people watch the documentary?
Well, Amazon, for one. There's a whole list of places. It's on nearly all the view-on-demand channels in America.
How do you see the music business has changed from his time period to now?
You know, in some ways it hasn't at all, and in some ways it has. you know, the music industry is really artists who very much want to succeed. And despite the fact that people think artists are uncompromising, they're very compromising, because artists, above everything, want to succeed and have the love of an audience and the feeling of success on stage. And so they do compromise with the industry as it is at the time when they want that success. And the industry today is... The main difference in the industry is the infrastructure. You know, we don't put out records and we have streaming. But if you think of the industry as what it really is, which is big corporations who fund finding new artists who make recordings, and we listen to them, we monetize the artists by buying a record or paying for streaming. Really, nothing's changed. It's just, instead of records, we stream. And before records, don't forget, it was all done with buying sheet music. And so the structure of the industry hasn't really changed. It's the difference is what we spend our money on to make sure the artist is paid for what he creates. But the attitudes stay the same. The corporate attitude has not changed one bit. It still grabs all it can and treats artists with a lot of disrespect, although verbally they come out there, you know, the heads of corporations never stop talking about how we respect and love our artists. But it's a load of crap, honestly. They just, you look at, you know, the end of year Universal report, and you know, Lucian Grange gets up on stage and talks for an hour for Universal. All he talks about for the whole hour is money, 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 money. What each department made, how much they're planning to make, what the projection is for next year. And he says, oh, we're very proud of the music. But what he means, we're very proud of the money it made. That never changes. And I'm not sure it should change, because if you like I said, these corporations represent the government of the business. You don't want your government to be bankrupt. I mean, I'm not maligning it. I'm just saying that is how it's structured. And then below the corporations, you've got the people who work in a more freewheeling way, which includes the artists, certainly unsigned artists, and a lot of producers and music publishers these days who don't want to work in the corporate way. And a lot of managers now who are taking their artists out of the corporate thing and managing to create their own record companies and find ways of selling the records without having to go through the major corporations. But the major corporations are very clever at gathering it up, you know, saying, look, you won't get proper distribution. They own half the streaming companies, so they can pretty much say, they can pretty much control it still. But as I say, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just something you have to learn to deal with.
So are you still looking for artists to manage?
Manage? You mean being woken up at 3 a.m. saying I'm worried about my hair? No. but, you know, it's impossible not to be fascinated by artists. And after 50 years of doing it, I know them so well. So you can never say no. Because if the right artist comes along, you just say, oh, I have to do it. No matter what pain this is going to give me, I have to do it. But what I prefer to do is work with the managers. I like the artists. I say, get a manager, and if your manager's inexperienced, don't worry. I'll manage the manager, and they can be the one who, you know, the artists are difficult people. And I prefer the day-to-day manager to have that difficulty.
So what has been your favorite moment in your music career?
Oh, well, it was quite fun sitting in the VIP box at the concert in Beijing, where I sat next to the British ambassador and a member of the Chinese Politburo, knowing that 2 years of going backwards and forwards to China had paid off, and I'd got Wham into China, and they were playing this amazing concert, which was hugely successful, because the purpose of it was to break the group in America. It was nothing to do with China. And during that week they were in China, they were on ABC, NBC, CBS News 24/7, every hour on the top of the news bulletin. And within 3 weeks of playing in China, we were booking a stadium tour in America, which would have taken another 2 years. So that on that basis, it was very successful. But that felt good. But there'd been other things too. Japan is a group you mentioned just now, and I managed Japan, who were the most left field rock group. And people said, look, they're wonderful music, but they'll never get a hit. And we did get hits. I mean, it took 5 years to get them their first hit. And then they became really one of the most influential rock groups in Europe. Not so much in America, but in Europe, they were hugely influential. And, you know, their influences are both deep and surface. On the surface, Duran Duran stole the lead singer, David Sylvian. They stole his hair and decided they'd all have his hair. You know, next thing, they had a hit. I mean, sometimes how you look gets you the hit, or helps the hit become a hit. Gary Newman, who you may or may not know in America.
Yeah, yeah. Cars.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, he stole David's voice, you know. Paul Young, another big singer in America, stole Mick Karn's bass playing and put it behind his singing, which was the most distinctive thing about his hit records. They were a very, very influential group. So I felt very good about sticking with them 5 years and breaking them. So, but there was, as you say, a high point. That's a difficult one to hit, a high point. It's a long, slow build. Looking back, it was a high point, but I can't actually put my finger on one particular high point there. High points have to be pretty exciting, don't they?
So are you on social media where people can track you down?
Yeah, I mean, you can, if you go to my Facebook, you find it under my name, but mainly I write on Substack, and then every week I put that onto Facebook. So I'm not doing much. I do a few things on Facebook. If something crops up, I put it there. But I have a website, I have Facebook, I have Instagram. But at the same time, I'm not the young people. I don't belong to the generation who loves it. I have to do it so I don't look too old.
Exactly. I hear you there. Well, Simon, I really appreciate you being here today on Entertainment World TV. You're an amazing guest, and thank you for your career with George, creating one of the greatest male vocalists of all time.
Well, you broke that first record, so you helped that too. You may get more credit in America than I do.
I doubt that, but I appreciate it.
Anyway, lovely talking to you.
Well, that wraps another School of Hollywood. I hope you enjoyed it today, and if you did, please give us a like and tell your friends about it. Until next time, school is out.